Welcome back to Sepsis Voices with Dr. Ron. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Daniels, and I'm the founder and joint chief executive of the UK Sepsis Trust. Today, I'm joined by Rob Barron, CBE, who was appointed as Parliamentary and Health Service Ombudsman and chair of that organisation on the 6th of April 2017. And Rob has considerable experience, therefore, of investigating allegations of public service failure and, as a result, bringing redress to service users. Thank you so much for joining us today, Rob.
It's a great pleasure and a privilege. Thank you for having me.
So as you approach the end of your tenure, we thought it was a great opportunity to sort of to reflect as well as look forward, looking at the sepsis landscape and particularly focus on what has changed and critically what hasn't changed since the Ombudsman's Office first published the report A Time to Act, which was way back in September 2013. And for our listeners, this report was at that time the Ombudsman's first clinical report and focused on 10 complaints that were investigated about patients with sepsis who didn't receive the treatment they urgently needed. And it was found that in some cases with better care and treatment, those people might have survived. So Rob, in the decade since your organisation's initial report on sepsis, A Time to Act, what specific improvements in the care and recognition of people with sepsis have you observed, if any?
Thank you. First of all, I have to pay tribute to your contribution to that report in 2013, which was essential and historic. The story is a mixed one, as you know. I think the two big changes are that as a result of the report, NICE, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, published guidelines to help NHS staff recognise and treat sepsis more quickly. And I think that is fundamental. I'm aware that that guidance is now being reviewed or has just been reviewed. And so it's a continuing process. But without that, and we can return to it, nothing much is going to happen because we rely on clinicians to make very difficult judgments. I think the second thing was that Public Health England, the responsible body at the time, took responsibility for increasing public awareness of sepsis. And together with your organisation, which played a central role, ever since there has been not just one, but several national campaigns to increase awareness of sepsis symptoms. What strikes me is that every time I see a sepsis case, during my 7 years, there's still a lack of awareness about what sepsis is, how to recognize it. And there's still issues about clinicians spotting it quickly enough to be able to do something about what is a deadly disease. But could I just say this? Most of the complaints to the Ombudsman are about health issues. And sepsis is very interesting to me from many points of view, but particularly from the number of high-profile campaigners who have experienced sepsis in their family and have turned around and used that lived experience to the benefit of the wider community and to my organisation and our case handlers to describe what it was like, what happened, and how we could do better in addressing those issues. And, you know, the roll call is just brilliant. You know, Scott and Sue Morris, James Titcomb, Melissa Mead, and now Merope Mills and Paul Laherty. These are just wonderful people who have transformed a public understanding of what is needed by their relentless contribution to raising awareness on the issue. So I think that is a lesson for raising awareness, that you have to take lived experience and use it.
Absolutely, Rob, and you know, I would echo your tribute to those people, and to me, the qualities they share are that they've all been through what for most of us, thankfully, is unimaginable pain, and continue to go through that pain, but they have determined to use it to effect good, and are incredibly effective at doing that. And again, I can only echo your tribute to them. They are critical to our purpose.
You so, know, we invited Scott to talk to our staff, to talk to our open meetings. We did the same with James. They've been very generous with their time, including with people that they had disagreements with at the time of their own cases. They've been on Radio Ombudsman, all of them, and it's just been humbling to see the way they've moved what has been a tragedy into a positive, better experience.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, moving towards the present, very recently, you've published a new report on sepsis, yeah, entitled The Spotlight on Sepsis, Your Stories, Your Rights. Are you able to summarise the key takeaway messages from this report?
Yes. It's a glass half full. In many ways, the situation which we have seen 10 years on is not terribly different from what the situation was in 2013. We have seen the same failings in relation to diagnosing and treating sepsis. We've seen the same organizational issues about the lack of training, the lack of senior input at critical moments, the failure to address things in a timely way, particularly as far as antibiotics are concerned, and a failure of protocols in handover in hospitals. So that is, in a way, disappointing, because it shows that however much has changed, there's still the fundamental issues to keep addressing.
Yes.
I think it's very interesting. We didn't make fundamental recommendations this time. We thought about that very carefully. And I take the same view as other people who've written reports. We know what the issues are. Just creating new recommendations isn't going to change that. We have to use the experience of the failure in cases to remind people what has to be done.
Yes, absolutely. How does this make you feel, Rob, as someone who's very close to all of these complaints and these investigations, and the fact that the themes really are, well, almost identical to those highlighted in 2013? How does that make you feel personally?
Yeah. So an ombudsman must never feel frustrated. If an ombudsman begins to be frustrated, they lose sight of their purpose, which is to continually remind those in power that however good the bodies they are responsible for might be, there are still issues that need to be addressed, and they have to be reminded continuously about this, and you have to create the necessary environment for change to take place. So frustration, possibly disappointment, yes, that's all there. But the key thing is to get on with the business of trying to address the detriments that people have experienced, the heartache as a result of these failures. And that makes me more determined, not less determined, because nobody is now saying that our approach or your approach is inappropriate. Of course, the health service has fundamental challenges which we can't forget about, But it doesn't mean to say that we stop addressing this issue.
Yes, and obviously you mentioned there the challenges that the healthcare system faces, and I think there have been barriers and blocks to healthcare organisations wanting to implement a lot of the recommendations arising from the individual report. Are you able to sort of describe from your perspective looking into the healthcare system whether there have been a sort of any common barriers to organisations that have wanted to implement change?
Yeah, first of all, and I don't think they're confined to sepsis, actually. I think there's a common issue. The common issue is about the suboptimal culture of the NHS in many parts. You know, the NHS is staffed by brilliant people like you, clinicians, porters, managers. They do the best that they can in general. But through no individual's fault, the culture is a defensive one. Mm-hmm. It's one where there's not sufficient communication between people who work as clinicians, between the clinicians themselves, between managers and clinicians, and between clinicians, managers, and patients. And all of that has tended to push bodies in jurisdiction to think about their reputation rather than patient safety issues. And that applies to sepsis just as it applies to eating disorders or cancer or avoidable death, wherever it is. And it is, for me, the primacy of patient safety and getting that to be recognized that gets in the way of more effective responses to what we do. So I just add to that that most of my counterparts in other countries have the power of own initiative to address issues which haven't been complained about by patients or members of the public. I don't have that power. So I can only rely on the individual cases that are brought to me. And sometimes we put them together for these strategic reports, which I think are useful. But it puts a big emphasis on individual institutions responding positively and effectively to the recommendations that we make. And that doesn't always happen.
That's fascinating about your peers in other countries, Rob. I'd been completely unaware of that. And if I may, and please jump in if you disagree or have something to add. I just wonder whether it might be helpful for listeners who are health professionals who are thinking, well, if we do exist in this defensive culture, what can I as an individual do to change my behaviour or my practice around that? And just the one sort of bugbear of mine that I'd urge health professional listeners to think about is the conditional apology that we hear so many times. I'm sorry that you feel that way. I'm sorry if you believe this had happened. Let's please give patients, families, where either harm has occurred or an outcome hasn't been what they had hoped, an absolute apology. I am sorry that this has happened. I think that's one small step that we can all take that is in almost all circumstances the right thing to do. Would you agree or disagree, or do you have any other advice for individuals?
I absolutely agree. And this is difficult. It's difficult because I'm not a clinician, okay? I have spent my life being rescued from various ailments by the National Health Service on one or two occasions in very serious circumstances. And I owe my existence to the brilliance of nurses and doctors who have looked after me. And I, you know, that needs to be put on the table because all of us are in debt to the genius of the health service. But that doesn't mean to say that we shouldn't be looking objectively at what sometimes happens in some situations which shouldn't happen. And it's not just me or my reports. You know, one of the great public servants of our time is Bill Kirkup, who has written substantially on the culture in organizations that he's investigated, particularly around maternity, but not just around maternity. And what he shows is that actually, in critical circumstances, doctors don't talk to each other. There's a hierarchy of prestige amongst clinicians, that there's sometimes disputes between midwives, nurses, and clinicians, and that records are not properly taken and sometimes regrettably altered after people have died. Now, all of that is true. All of that needs looking at. It's part of continuing professional development. And it's not confined to the health service. You know, it's true in the ombudsman world as well. There are suboptimal cultures in the ombudsman world. I've just spent a year following the proceedings of the National Assembly in South Africa, which has rightly impeached the ombudsman there, the national ombudsman, for unacceptable behavior and bias. So, you know, it's, if we're calling out doctors for occasional lapses in appropriate behavior, that's part of professional life. It's not an attempt to have a go at doctors. And I would just say this, that one of the people I'm most impressed with in this area is Sarah Barclay, who runs the Medical Mediation Foundation. And she promotes the prospect that doctors can learn how to mediate with people without admitting blame, and learn and understand without, as you say, getting into conditional apologies or litigation. And I think the medical profession has been very slow to come to that. So, you know, I've occasionally been criticised by the Select Committee in Parliament for not speeding up the amount of mediation we can do or promote between doctors and patients. But what they forget is that you need the consent of both parties for mediation to take place. And probably because of COVID, which made life very difficult, that has been slower coming down the line than in other ways. But it's not an attack on doctors. It's an attempt to get professionalism more tuned to patient needs. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I absolutely do. And I was reflecting while you were speaking, Robert, around, you know, the recent significant attention to Martha's Rule, the right of any family or any patient to seek a second opinion. And I think this is just as important as that. This is around opening up those lines of conversation, that if a harm event has happened, or if an outcome, it need not be a harm event, if an outcome hasn't been as favourable as a family or a patient might have hoped, it's the sort of the opportunity and the right and the openness to have an informal post-hoc conversation, to air questions and concerns that a family or a patient might have. And if that happened more frequently, then I have a suspicion that your successor might have an easier ride through fewer complaints. But unfortunately, we put so many barriers up to that happening.
I think you're right. I think the salient point about Merope Mills and Paul Laity is how articulate and well-educated and reasonable they are and have been as advocates. And yet what they say is they found it very difficult to have a proper conversation with clinicians. I think because they felt they were patronized for their concerns about Martha. Mm. Now, if that is the case with her, a highly educated, articulate woman, we go back to the case of Robbie Powell, who died 33 years ago from undiagnosed Addison's disease. Mr. Powell has been campaigning every day for the last 30 years to get a public inquiry. Without those kinds of skills, though still a formidable campaigner. And you know, you have to make the point that he's disadvantaged because he wasn't, he didn't have the luck to have the skills and the support that Merope Mills has had. And it made it very difficult for him to get his voice heard amongst the medical profession and the Crown Prosecution Service and so on. And that is still an open sore, and there should be a public inquiry to look at it.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, as we said earlier, families like Merope and Paul, you know, have achieved so much through their pain, their anguish, but their resilience and their determination to see good come out of their tragedy. And they're just incredible people like that. And we've mentioned a number of them. Now, I do think we have something of an opportunity, and speaking as a clinician, and obviously I'm not expecting you to respond as a clinician, with sepsis now, in that NICE, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence has just updated its sepsis guideline, which, you know, non-clinical listeners might not be aware of or not understand the importance of. But we've been in a state of, well, confusion, frankly, in the space of sepsis for a couple of years now. And I think this NICE guideline gives us opportunity for the NHS to move forward in a consistent and cohesive way in the space of sepsis, in that we can all use similar guidance to recognise sepsis and to initiate the immediate treatment. Yeah. How important do you think it is for organisations like NICE to give this national leadership in really very complex and hard to spot and hard to treat conditions like sepsis?
Yeah, I think I've got a number of things to say about that. First of all, I welcome the development. I have spent time reading the coroner's reports put together by Emily Townsend at the Health Service Journal about people who died from sepsis as a result of clinical failure. And what struck me about that was that sepsis often develops, I think, where there are comorbidities. So it is asking a great deal of clinicians to be clear about when they act and how they act in that very difficult circumstance. And as a non-clinician who relies on independent clinical advice for everything that every judgment I make about clinical cases, I have respect for the difficulty of that process. So it's easy to criticize and to say it should change, but unless there is clear guidance and support for the professional development of clinicians, then not a lot is going to change as far as that's concerned. So this is welcome, this is important. I think the awareness of sepsis protocols by clinicians is still quite low. You know, there was one terrible case in Emily's list of one set of clinicians who thought it was a nuisance to abide by the sepsis protocols, and therefore they didn't use it. I mean, that is shocking. But in general, the mistakes are honest ones. That's important. So if you don't have that, if you don't have the necessary training, and I know how balkanized the health service is. So you can say we need more training, but where it comes from and who authorizes it is an absolute nightmare to join together. You know, it is a horribly overregulated profession, in my view. I've never come across anything quite like it. And that is not good. So I think there are five or six things that are fundamental to getting this right. And at the bottom, the top, is the awareness of clinicians about what they have to do. You know, another thing is the awareness of the general public and of patients about these issues, so they can prompt the kind of prompting that is necessary where there's some doubt. And there needs to be fundamental transparency in order to review the situation. But unless the clinicians are competent to deal with it, we're in a very difficult situation.
Yeah, indeed. And I like to describe this this need as a partnership. Sepsis doesn't have a sentinel event like a heart attack or a stroke, where at one point the person is relatively well or is as well as they normally are, and the next moment they have a sudden change. This is an insidious, gradual condition that builds, and there's no sort of time point at which we can reliably identify it. So we have to have this partnership, don't we, between a public who are aware and know where, when and how to access healthcare, and health professionals who are empowered and exist in a culture that they can employ that training and deliver that immediate response to these patients. And a critical part of that is, of course, listening, isn't it? Health professionals listening to patients, listening to their families. And that's even more important when an individual has altered communication. And I'm just conscious of the recent report around the tragic death of a young boy with autism, Matias Vieira, yeah, who, you know, didn't communicate as others normally might. And perhaps that had impact on him. And, you know, this can't be specific to sepsis. How common a theme in your investigations is a failure to adequately listen to families?
It is part and parcel of the weakness of aspects of NHS culture. And it happens time and time again, and it leads to many, many tragedies and avoidable deaths. And, you know, Melissa Mead makes the same point. I don't think she knew what sepsis was, but she knew something was wrong, but she couldn't get people to listen to her. I think in the Merope Mills case, she felt patronized and not listened to. And it wasn't in that case because they were under so much pressure at work, and therefore they had to divide their time. They weren't as it came to that. So I think this is absolutely at the heart of what is needed to listen more effectively to people. Now, I just want to say something else, that there are many doctors who behave utterly honourably by blowing the whistle when they think that there is a patient safety issue and become whistleblowers. And the experience that I've seen in various places around the country, particularly at University Hospitals Birmingham, where I've looked very closely, is that there the doctors were bullied and threatened by the managers of the organisation to drop their reports because it was interfering with the reputation of the organisation. And there's an element of that happening in the Lucy Letby case, where the doctors actually had to apologise for bringing concerns about the person who committed these crimes to her before she was arrested. So the whistleblowing laws don't work properly. Doctors have been traduced. We're looking at Chris Day at the moment going going through the courts. They have the book thrown at them in a way which discourages them being frank and open. And the other thing is the duty of candor, which should be the ally of people in the health service. That doesn't work properly either. And the ministry says it's going to look at that. Well, I hope it does do, because that is in a mess and that needs reform. So I don't want to say that doctors or nurses are the problem. There are a whole host of issues around the culture which need to be addressed.
Yeah, I mean, I have extreme sympathy with that perspective. And I think it's not just organisational. It sort of rubs off on the tribes of health professionals. And I think you see some of that behaviour in social media. And I had personal experience of that during the deepest throes of COVID-19, or really after the initial waves. And I sort of started to not try to claim that COVID-19 wasn't horrific and wasn't a huge burden on the NHS, because of course it was both of those things, but to say that actually there's some unintended consequence of lockdowns, and not draconian, but some of the more restrictive aspects of our approach as a country to COVID-19. And I remember being shot down by health professionals for even daring to say that, you know, perhaps we need to think about these unintended consequences. So, I mean, you know, I don't know whether you agree or disagree, but I think there's an element of tribalism at play as well as the organisational culture.
Look, I've been to health service journal conferences in Manchester. Tribalism is a good description of what it is, and it's not terribly healthy. But you can't be a tribalist in response to tribalism. You've got to try and raise your game, my game, so that you're not seen as an adversary, but you're somebody who's there to try and make it better.
Absolutely, and that a different perspective should be considered, if not embraced, at least considered fairly. Now, you mentioned that one of the cases that Emily Townsend highlighted in the Health Service Journal recently was around, you know, doctors very reluctant or seeing these sepsis protocols as a nuisance. And I'm, you know, conscious that there has been some professional disquiet around, well, if we focus excessively on one condition, it inevitably detracts from the quality of care for another condition. But there's also, of course, you know, sepsis is almost unique in that the therapy that benefits individual patients, delivering that therapy has potential to impact on population level harm in with the spectre of antimicrobial resistance. Have your investigations sort of suggested that a hesitancy to give antibiotics because of a fear of precipitating antimicrobial resistance has been a problem?
You know, the honest answer, and it's a very quick and simple one, is no.
Okay.
We haven't looked at that, and perhaps we should in forthcoming cases, but I'm in no position to give a response to that.
No, and I appreciate your candor there. And for listeners, I would simply highlight that there are pretty good data from our own Royal Pharmaceutical Society, together with data, admittedly surrogate data in the case of the United States, but pretty good data from Ireland, were three areas where, in the United States case, New York State, where there have been significant and resource sepsis improvement programs that quite convincingly demonstrate that they've not been associated with an increased total use of antimicrobials in hospitals. So I think we need to keep a very close eye on this. I think obviously no one wants to give antimicrobials injudiciously to people, but there are data out there that seem to suggest that the two priorities are absolutely compatible. So we've touched on this. We've touched on the public awareness and the education of our public, and we've talked about the fact that we have to empower our public. We have to get the message out there. But we're also aware that less well-represented communities are particularly at risk. And there have been recent data from the National Child Mortality Database, as well as a publication from the University of Manchester, showing that the groups most vulnerable to sepsis are those living in areas of higher socioeconomic deprivation, together with people of non-Caucasian ancestry, and particularly at risk are people or living in with families of Pakistani descent. And, you know, do you think, well, I know the answer to this, it's a clear no, that charities like ours are good at reaching into those communities. And, you know, how can we get better at this? How can we reach and make accessible the messaging to groups who are less able to access it?
Yeah, I think you should not be criticized in any way. I think, first of all, the Ombudsman Office is not terribly well known amongst citizens in the United Kingdom. I've got some good stories to tell about that, but I won't tell you them now. What that means is that we have to get out and make ourselves known to people who wouldn't ordinarily come to us. So we've developed the concept of the Ombudsman Roadshow, in which we go to different parts of the country and sit in with people and voluntary organizations to demonstrate who we are and what use we might be. This week I've been to Blackpool. I've met the kind of people you're talking about, the people least likely to complain. And it's been a brilliant, humbling experience to do that. And we all have to reach out. The other thing about Blackpool was there is, through an alliance between the voluntary sector, central government, the health service, and local government, a contingency of people who are reaching out to people in very vulnerable situations, as far as drugs, in prison, as far as alcohol and poverty, homelessness, and are trying to help them right on the front line. And I think that is brilliant, and that is the way to do it. So that has to be done. And there's good, you know, there's good practice around that we can all learn from. The other thing, though, is coming back to my point, there has to be legislative reform to give my office the power of own initiative, because the very people that you're describing are the people who won't use our services because it's either intimidating or alien or somehow not easy for them to connect. It's not helped by the MP filter in non-health cases. But even leaving that aside, if we could look at issues that aren't complained about, it would make a hell of a difference. And I think that's very important. Don't kick yourself. You know, you're doing a brilliant job.
Well, yes, but as you know, and as you've indicated for your organisation, there's so much more that we need to do, so much better, and we just need empowering to do it, and as well as having the desire and ambition to do it. And we touched on this in a separate meeting yesterday, didn't we, Rob? That wasn't related to this podcast. That, you know, I think both our organisations have a desire to look at the findings from this latest report, to reflect on the findings from A Time to Act back in 2013, and to actually work out what we can do together to do more to effect change. Have you got any sort of immediate reflections on that conversation yesterday?
I do. I think it was a magnificently frank conversation, in which we had a common view that unless you're joined up across organizational boundaries, across public administration into the voluntary sector, in trying to reach out to people, it's not going to work. And that is true of your organization and mine. Historically, it's been shown to be the case. And we've got to keep on doing it in a targeted way and not think that one organization can deal with this. So, and there's lots of possibilities here. There's something called the Health Regulators Forum, which includes all the health regulators, they are a possible vehicle to work not only between regulators, but with the voluntary sector and organisations like yours on specific issues as well. And I think one of my concerns is that the regulators, excellent as they all are not sufficiently joined up in deciding how we can all act together.
Yeah, there's almost a single word that describes a lot of what we've been discussing. You could say openness, but this is about collaboration, isn't it? This is about working together with a common purpose. And as you know, Rob, we're trying to bring together a multi-stakeholder meeting to reflect on the recent NICE guidance and including your organisation to decide, well, where do we go with this? How do we push this forward? How do we create sustainable improvement? So we're coming to time now, Rob. You know, and obviously, as we know, you're sadly approaching the end of your tenure as ombudsman. Do you have any advice, or perhaps in light of your previous statement, any urges that you would like to see your successor deliver? So any advice or any drivers for change toward your successor?
So I've got three things to say about that. First of all, the big issue is who is going to be my successor, which I do not know. When will the decision be announced, which I do not know. And given that Parliament is going into recess and it has to be cleared by Parliament, the clock is ticking. And, you know, that is a serious situation that has to be resolved. That's the first thing. The second thing is that I've learned from a long career that you don't give any advice whatsoever to your successors, because it's not welcomed, and it's sometimes seen as patronizing and trying to continue your stay. So I'm sure whoever it is, providing there is a successor, that they will know what to do. But the third and final point is I've learned a lot about what makes me more effective in the last 7 years. And perhaps I could finish by just reflecting on that a little bit. The first is, it is a brilliant job because it is an independent job. I don't work for ministers. I report to Parliament. You have to use that independence, and you have to use it every day, because ministers don't want you to do what you're doing quite often if it's an embarrassment to the department. So, related, you have to speak truth unto power on a continuous basis. And that means you have to do difficult things. That's not always easy. I can remember in one big case on eating disorders, an NHS trust, on the morning we were going to publish it, the decision, which was critical of them, threatened us with a legal injunction and said, if you do this, we'll take you to the High Court. And we had a meeting and we said, well, we've done what we can. This is an insidious interference. So if they want to do it, let them do it and we'll get on with it. So we didn't buckle at that point when other people might have buckled. I think that's very important. But you have to not only speak truth unto power, you've got to work together with your stakeholders and with complainants and former complainants whenever possible. One of the best things that we have done in the last few years is create complaint standards for frontline bodies in the NHS. Those have been beautifully welcomed. You know, they're very important in setting out best practice so that complaints can be resolved on the front line rather than having to come to us. And they need the support of professional development. And we've provided that for 500 people so far. So it's much needed. Complaints handlers say to me, if you don't help us, no one else is going to help us, which I thought was quite interesting. So, but we've done it because we've co-produced it. We haven't said, this is what you have to do. We've done it with the bodies themselves in pilot schemes and working groups. So they feel it's theirs, not ours, which I think is very right. I think second to last thing is, our job is to promote public trust in institutions which are losing public trust across the board. And what that means is you have to be competent. If you're not competent, no one's going to trust you. So you have to do what you promised to do in terms of closing cases and the time it takes to deal with them. But you've also got to treat people with compassion, with respect, and treat them in the way they would wish to be treated. And, you know, too often, bureaucrats are not very good at doing that because they're under so much trouble. And two final things, never give up, because it's never going to end. We're never going to get to a position where we can say, OK, we're finished now. So you've got to be patient. And the very last thing is, you have to take your people with you. And so you have to live your values. If people don't see you doing what you're asking other people to do, they won't do it themselves. And I learned that very early in my ombudsman career. There's no point talking about these issues. You've got to practice them. And you're only as good as the people you work with.
That's extremely sage advice from for any leader, really, from my more limited experience. Rob, this has been a really insightful conversation, and I would just like to thank you personally and on behalf of the UK Sepsis Trust and the people we serve for everything you've done to raise awareness about sepsis and shortcomings within the NHS around it whilst working with the Ombudsman. And, you know, very best of luck to you for whatever is next in your career. Now, you can read the Ombudsman's report at www.ombudsman.org.uk, and of course continue to access our clinical tools and e-learning, all of which are now updated to reflect the changes to the NICE guideline via sepsistrust.org. Thank you for listening, and until next time.